hand is on my shoulder, and he's crying too. And he doesn't ask any questions, which I'm beyond grateful for. Handing the box over, I search for something memorable and eloquent to mark the occasion. Arlene was one of a kind, a true friend when I needed one, a grande dame from the old school. She was the sweetest of old ladies, and I will miss her dearly. All of these things are true, but the words I choose are far more profound. "She smelled like cookies," I whisper through tears. Ahab laughs, and so do I, and it occurs to me again how often laughter accompanies tears. Now Albert has joined us, and when I look up at him, the sun hits me squarely in the face. He slides his aviators into my hands, then pats me on the back. "Finder's fee," he says. Ahab lifts the gold chain off his neck. Dangling from the end, an old-fashioned skeleton key fits the lock perfectly. He turns his wrist, opening the box with a click. This is his, not mine. I pick up my backpack and walk halfway around the tank when his voice stops me. "You want to know what's inside?" Maybe it's the sun, or the emotion of reuniting Ahab with some piece of his dear dead aunt. But whatever the reason, in this moment, on the rooftop of this gas station, I miss my mother terribly. I turn, take one last look at Ahab, dripping wet in his ridiculous clothes, holding his precious wooden box. Behind him, his whale of a boyfriend is back in his chair, lounging in the shade, sipping a daiquiri like he's on the beaches of Aruba. "You could tell me," I say, rounding the tank. Then, slipping on Albert's aviators, I throw open the trap door. "But I probably wouldn't believe you." Chapter 22. The Mistress of Moxie. September 3. Mid-morning. Dear Isabel, dim the lights. Raise the curtains. Cue the amped-up percussive spy music. Film noir, not Bond. Standing in the shadows of trees, rooftop pools, and fat drunken slobs, our heroine comes face to face with a different kind of shadow, her arch-nemesis, Shadow Kid. Dun-dun-dun! Shadow Kid tests our heroine's theory that heroes are not without blemish, villains not without virtue. If Shadow Kid holds a single ounce of virtue in his heart, thinks our heroine, it is kept well hidden. It isn't the first time her theory has been put to test, and it won't be the last. With more than a little help from her sidekicks, our heroine escapes the clutches of Shadow Kid unscathed, unfettered, and unmurdered. Much to her chagrin, however, she now must deal with the inept Constable Randy, and though our heroine has done nothing wrong... Okay, cut, cut, cut. Sorry, Iz. I had every intention of keeping up the cloak-and-dagger Bogart 40s black-and-white bullshit, but honestly, I just don't have it in me. I'm too hungry. And pissed. I'm hungry and pissed, and I'm sure you understand. So, Northern Kentucky seems to be experiencing a substance and despair monsoon. How do I know this? Well, right now I'm sitting in an interrogation room at the Independence Police Station. I'm not under arrest or anything, but apparently little things like constitutional rights don't matter here in Independence. I know, the irony, I can't. Anyway, it appears I have some time on my hands, so let's talk reasons. Reason number 7 ends with a pill and begins with a grizzly bear. Here is a drawing of a grizzly bear. Feared, murdered, stuffed, admired. Ferocious? Yup. Out of place? Bingo. Key ingredient to the world's most awesome doctor's office waiting room? You bet your sweet ass. I still remember my first visit to Dr. McIndy's office like it was yesterday. The waiting room had toys for the kids and magazines for the parents, but it also had that life-sized stuffed grizzly. For everyone. On the first of what would turn out to be just under 100 visits to Dr. McIndy's office, I walked right up to that giant brown grizzly and touched its claw. I was 11 at the time, and it was a bear, so really, I had no choice. I mean, it was a bear. A bear. So I stood there, cowering in its ever-still shadow, staring into those great glassy eyes, positive the thing would come alive at any moment and swallow me whole. I recalled one of my favorite childhood stories, Pierre by Maurice Sendak, about a lion who swallowed a naughty boy named Pierre. Have you read that book? My God, it is deliciously macabre. Anyway, as I was quite a naughty child, I was sure the bear would turn out to be just like that lion, which is to say, I was sure he would swallow me whole. But he did not. "Mim," said my father, waving me over. Clearly, Dad had no respect for murdered-slash-stuffed bears. Reluctantly, I pulled myself away from the terrifying taxidermy and sat in the chair between Mom and Dad. "You're okay with being here, right?" said Dad. I nodded. There was, after all, a bear. Mom put her arm around me. "If you're uncomfortable with any of Dr. Mackindy's questions, just say the word, okay? We can leave whenever you want." Dad, thinking I couldn't see him, rolled his eyes. This eye roll, combined with a textbook nostril flare, would become his trademark, a look that would haunt me well into my teen years. "It might be tough sometimes," he said. "But you're tough, right? My tough girl. You'll answer whatever the doctor asks, won't you, tough girl?" I nodded because, whatever, there was a fucking bear right there. Anyway, I'll cut to the chase here, is, as a slew of doctor visits doesn't exactly make for stimulating reading. Dr. Mackindy, as it turned out, was more than a decent doctor. He was a decent man. He was short and round and always wore a bow tie. He was the only East Indian I've ever encountered who had red hair, like Weasley red. In fact, he used to joke that he was Irish in hiding. "My name is even camouflaged. Mackindy," he'd say. And then laugh, effing heartily. He let me talk when I needed to talk, and he talked when I needed to listen. He even played Elvis in the background without my having to ask. Over the next 4 years, Mackindy and I took our time getting to the root, as he called it. His methods went like this. Wait, talk, think, watch, listen. Sitting with him required patience and a certain bold individuality. I had plenty of both, so it worked. Mackindy had his own practice, which I know doesn't really say much these days, but he really did it up old school. He wasn't tied down to any one notion of popular treatment or pulled hither and thither by powerful drug companies. He played games and told stories because, as he put it, life is more fictional than fiction. He did things his way, and that was good enough for me, and that was good enough for Mom. Dad was unconvinced. It started with a smart man named Schneider who wrote a smart book which helped a lot of people. Dad read this book and joined the ranks. Now, joining the ranks can be a good thing. Take NATO, for example, or cage-free eggs. But joining the ranks can also be a not-so-good thing. Take the Nazi Party, for example, or the rise of the McNugget. Dad bought into the notion that there was one right way to solve a problem, or rather, to solve my problem. And guess who wasn't solving my problem correctly? Hint, he owned a bear. At the beginning of what turned out to be our final session, before Dr. Mackindy even had a chance to get to the branch, much less the root, Dad stepped in. "We need to talk," he said. And just like some angsty, one-sided breakup, my father explained to affable Dr. Mackindy all the ways the good doctor had let us down. Schneider this and Schneider that. Mackindy's methods, while commendable, simply weren't relevant in this day and age. "What day and age is that, Mr. Malone?" asked Mackindy. "The day and age of new discoveries in the world of medicine," answered my father. Dr. Mackindy sat on the other side of his rickety wooden desk, peering over the top of his glasses, listening to my father expound secondhand thoughts. I remember watching his face as Dad talked, thinking, in a way, the man was a product of his own theories, more fictional than fiction. Countless hours of sessions we'd spent focusing on the facts, trying to reconcile reality with whatever unreality was in my own head. But if Dr. Mackindy, the Irish, Indian, bow-tie-wearing, grizzly-loving doctor himself had taught me anything, it was that our world could be astoundingly unrealistic. The good doctor removed his glasses and spoke quietly. "Symptoms of psychosis, Mr. Malone, are not themselves psychoses. as I'm sure Schneider himself would agree, were he here today. Alas, he is not. Most of his work, as I'm sure you know, was published in the 20s. He winked at me, looked back at my dad. The day and age of new discoveries in the world of medicine, was it not? 2 weeks later, I walked into a new doctor's office, one whose methods better fell in line with those of my father, one whose life had no fiction, no bow ties, no Elvis. He didn't even have a bear. If I were writing a book, Iz, this would be my chapter break. I mean, right? He didn't even have a bear. Boom, motherfuckers. So, I'm sick. Supposedly. And Dad is worried, obviously. I think he's afraid of history repeating itself in the worst way. The reason I'm bringing all this up now is because I just spent the better part of the morning staring down the business end of a foot-long hunting knife, which in and of itself is terrifying. Only here's the thing. If I'm honest with myself, the knife wasn't what I was afraid of. I was afraid of the person holding the knife. Shadow Kid. I don't know if you read comics, but if you do, you'll notice there usually isn't much that separates the villain from the hero. Lonely outcasts, masked identities, troubled childhoods, misunderstood by all. Very often, there's a pivotal scene toward the end, usually during a massive thunderstorm, wherein the villain tries to convince the hero that they're the same. This morning, Shadow Kid had me cornered, and all I could see were the great glassy eyes of a grizzly bear. Before long, the bear's eyes were my own, and I was convinced we were the same. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, but it sure felt like those thunderstorms from the comics. But then something happened. Standing there on that roof, I remembered once, years ago, when Dad took me mini-golfing. During a few of the earlier holes, I'd noticed a last-second flick of the wrist, or a fleeting smirk, which led me to believe he was putting forth less than his best effort. We were on the back half of the miniature course, the token giant windmill green. I don't remember who was winning at the time, but it was close. Closer than it should have been. "Dad," I said, "try this time." Picking up his quarter, he raised an eyebrow. "This time? I've been trying every time, Mim. You're a pro." I was standing behind him when he teed off. His ball rolled down the turf aisle, a straight shot through the tiny tunnel, narrowly missing a windmill blade, then through to the other side. From where we were standing, the 6-foot windmill blocked our view of the hole, making it impossible to see where Dad's ball had landed. "Pretty sure I shanked it," said Dad. "I'll go check." He rested his putter on his shoulder and strolled around the windmill out of sight. While he was gone, I noticed the green ahead of us had one of those fold-out circus mirrors. Its position made it look as though there were 6 or 7 holes, effectively camouflaging the true hole. A young couple kept hitting their golf balls into the mirror, cursing, then smiling like they didn't care. For a second, I tried to figure out which of the holes was the real one. And then I saw it. One side of the mirror was angled toward the hole in our green. In its reflection, I saw Dad pull his ball out of our hole, then set it down by the edge of the walkway, a good 10 feet away. He threw on a smile, then rounded the windmill back on my side. "Yep," he said, shrugging. "Shanked it." Dad, for all his faults, was still Dad. He didn't just will himself to lose that game so I might win. He rigged it, so that there was no other way. I had people who loved me, people who cheated to lose. There's really something to this, Iz, something that separates me from Shadow Kid, and I think this is what makes the storm pass. People say I'm sick. Dad sure believes it. At his insistence, I've been on meds for the past year or so. Shit. Constable Randy returns. Long story short, I'm not going to take the medication anymore because I don't need it. Mom never thought so, and neither did Mackenzie. Abilitol is its name, and it is reason number 7. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone. Grizzly, whoa, man! "Are you done?" I nod, stuff my journal away, and give the officer my sarcastic, undivided attention look. It's a good one. We aren't suspects, a fact I pointed out twice before he dropped us in this room. But this hasn't kept Independence's finest from treating Walt and me like bottom feeders.
Okay, then, says Officer Randy, plopping his awkward frame across the table. What do you think a man in my position should do?
I want to ask him what position he thinks he's in. Survey says, bowling ball on a straw. Seriously, in all my years I've never seen a noodle like his, like someone grabbed him by both feet and blew air into his toes. This man is one hard sneeze away from scoliosis. I don't understand the problem, I say. We already told you what happened on the roof. You can't keep us here. We've done nothing wrong. Randy shuffles his papers around. Blimey, looking at his giant head almost makes me wish I'd stared at that dumb eclipse with both eyes wide open.
You know what I did yesterday?
He asks.
Arrested an accused child molester. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm less than cordial.
The words of Officer Randy take me there.
I'd like to be friends, Mim. You want to be friends, don't you?
The clicking of Walt's cue brings me back. It's quiet for a moment. Officer Randy sighs, says,
Okay, look, bottom line. I've got two minors involved in a possible murder attempt.
Dude, we were the murderees, not the murderers.
I know that. And under normal circumstances, I'd call your parents, explain the situation, tell you to expect calls from an attorney, and send you on your merry way. But these aren't normal circumstances, it would seem. These are very odd circumstances.
Constable, you have no idea.
Because when I ask you a simple question, what's your name, where are you from, where are your folks, you clam up. Ahab vouches for both of you, says you're heading to Iowa or something, but he's a moron. Either way, that's not enough to...
Cleveland, says Walt.
Randy frowns at him.
What? Cleveland, not Iowa.
Walt has his head down, completely enthralled with his cube. Think fast, Malone. I lean in across the desk and lower my voice. Okay, fine. Officer? My name is Betty, and this is my brother, Rufus, and we're from Cleveland. A few years back, I was self-diagnosed with abandonment issues and...
Self-diagnosed?
Randy interrupts. What did I say?
You said self-diagnosed.
That's right. Next to me, Walt is nodding emphatically. So anyway, I continue, after our parents died, my brother here was put under my guardianship.
How old are you, Betty?
Officer Randy asks, scribbling away in a notebook. 18, I answer, barely able to keep a straight face. So I took Rufus here under my wing. Well, I've had a few abandonment episodes recently, real ugly shit, you understand? So we're headed to Boise to live with our Aunt Gertie. I've got a job lined up with Pringles, and Auntie G has agreed to let us live in her bonus room above the garage. Randy's pen stops abruptly.
Boise's in Idaho.
He whispers, a gotcha smile spreading across his huge face.
Ahab said, Iowa.
I clear my throat and cross my arms. Yeah, well, like you said, officer, Ahab's a moron. Officer Randy furrows his bulging brow. Dear God, please let him buy this story. There's no telling what sort of chain reaction a curious cop in northern Kentucky might set off. I could kiss my objective goodbye, that's for sure.
You guys wait here, he says. I'm gonna get on the horn with the captain and see what I can do about getting you to Boise.
The human bobblehead wobbles from the room. I hop up, poke my head out the door, and watch him disappear around the corner. Okay, Walt, listen up. I turn, expecting him to be in la-la land with his cube. Instead, he's standing right behind me, smiling, suitcase in hand. God bless him. We're not arrested, but it looks like we're going to have to break out of jail. You with me?
Hey, hey, yeah,
he says, bouncing on his heels. Closing my good eye, I will every ounce of stealth, speed, and moxie into the toes of my Goodwill shoes. Mom, the flame of my fuse, the wind in my sail, the tick-tick-ticking clock in my ear is sick. Labor Day is 2 days away. 48 hours. I breathe in, out, in,
out. I am energized. I am galvanized. I am mobilized, oxidized, and fully realized. I am Mary Iris Malone, the mistress of Moxie. Stepping lightly into the hallway, my trusty high tops lead us onward, ever onward, through the small town bustlings of the Independence Police Station. We fly past the bulletproof window protecting the captured dregs of society, past the closet-sized kitchen with its engine oil coffee and floppy box of day-old donuts. With buoyed spirits, surging stealth, and the whitewater rapids of adrenaline, we follow my Velcro-laden friends into the foyer of the station, past the old lady in hysterics over her lost cat, past the debauched he-she and cowboy, cowgirl, chaps, past the gorgeous guy with a black eye. I stop on a dime. Walt runs into my back, giggling. The guy with the black eye. It's him. 17C from the Greyhound.
Come on, says Walt, still chuckling under his breath. We're breaking out of jail.
He grabs my sleeve and pulls every part of me, save my heart, out the front door.
Chapter 23. The Many Perfections of Beck Van Buren.
Sorry, little lady. Can't sell it to you without you got a valid driver's license.
The guy pulls an apple out of I don't know where, then plants it in his Moses beard. I can only assume there's a mouth in there somewhere. After our prison break, I was all set to hitchhike when Walt spotted a for sale sign in the window of a blue pickup in this guy's yard. The problem is this. For certain, shall we say, cycloptic reasons, I've avoided taking the driver's test like the plague. I pull my permit, which the great state of Ohio only requires a written exam to obtain, from my backpack, and flash the card in Moses' face. I have this. Same thing, basically. He cracks a bite of his apple. Damn thing is crisp. Chews, says nothing. Walt unlatches his old suitcase, pulls out his Rubik's Cube, and gets to work. Moses raises his eyebrows. I can actually see his patience waning.
Okay, fine, I say, pulling out a wad of cash. How about $300? That's $50 more than you're asking, cash in hand.
Walt clicks the red squares into place, claps me on the shoulder, and does a little jig right there on the front porch.
What's wrong with him? Asks Moses, still eyeballing Walt.
He's Walt, man. What's your excuse? Moses stops chewing momentarily, then backs up to shut the door.
Okay, no, wait, look, I'm sorry. My friend and I just walked from the police station, so we're...
You see Randy down there?
He asks, cracking another bite.
What?
Officer Randy, you see him?
Yeah, but...
How is that old son of a bitch? Still a rat bastard?
I am Mary Iris Malone, a baffled bag of bones. Are you gonna sell me your truck or not?
Not, he says with a mouthful.
I twist my mom's lipstick in my pocket. Okay, I think we got off on the wrong foot.
Kid, I got stuff to do. Without a license, I can't sell her to you. Now you and your friend here need to clear off my porch.
I have a license, says a voice behind us. I turn to find 17C scrolling through pictures on his camera, standing in the front yard like a deep-rooted tree, like he's been there for years. Somehow that black eye only makes him more desirable.
And you are? Asks Moses.
A. Perfect. B. The god of devastating attractiveness. C. A flawless specimen created in a lab by mad scientists in an effort to toy with the heart of Mary Iris Malone. D. All of the above. I circle D. Final effing answer. He sticks his camera in a duffel bag and straps it around his chest. I'm Beck, he says, stepping up onto the porch and throwing an arm around my shoulder. Her disapproving big brother. He turns sideways mere inches from my face. I thought I told you to wait for me in the parking lot, sis. Pushing my bangs out of my eyes, I'd pay literally, probably, I don't know, maybe $400 for 5 minutes of prep time in a mirror right now.
Oh, right, I say. Sorry, bro,
forgot.
My usual witty vocabulary seems to have regressed into mushy, fragmented infant speak.
Beck sighs, leans in toward Moses.
She'd lose her arm if it wasn't attached.
Head, I mutter.
What?
I'd lose my head if it wasn't attached. I roll my eyes, praying it looks sisterly.
What did I say?
Asks Beck.
You said arm.
He gives a pfft.
I don't think so.
Walt, I say. Without looking up from his cube, Walt corroborates.
The new boy said arm.
Beck shrugs and turns back toward a bewildered Moses. I can almost hear the rusty wheels churning in his head, processing our little production. From somewhere behind him, he pulls out another apple and cracks a bite.
You said cash, right?
Walt tosses his old suitcase in the bed of the truck. We pile in and pull out of Moses the apple eater's front yard. Beck mentions food, to which Walt and I hastily agree. On top of being insanely hungry, I'm not relishing the idea of exchanging stories with Beck. I'd love to know who he is and where he's going, not to mention how he got from the Greyhound bus yesterday to the Independence police station today, but I'm sure he's wondering the same about me. We'll catch up, but we'll do so with full stomachs. At Walt's prodding, Beck pulls into a line of cars at a fast food place called Medieval Burger. When this trip is over, I'm going to have to look into one of those trendy full-body cleanses, something to detox all this processed meat out of my system. Did they even have burgers in the Middle Ages? I wonder aloud.
Oh, sure, says Beck. Nothing more refreshing after a long day of crusading and pillaging and walking through the mud and what have you.
Oh, God, he's witty. The Middle Ages were quite damp, weren't they?
And dreary.
Walt flips on the vintage turndial radio of the old truck and scans the waves. Landing on a Reds versus Cubs baseball game, he claps his hands and leans in to listen. The line inches forward, stops.
So? Says Beck.
I turn to find him looking at me, arms crossed.
So what?
How about a name, for starters?
How about your name?
I already told you it's Beck.
I just figured that was, you know, an alias or something.
Before he can respond, his cell phone rings. Pulling it from his jacket, he checks the caller ID and answers.
Yeah, hey.
Pause.
No.
Longer pause.
Claire, listen.
I become inexplicably interested in the analog clock in the dashboard. It appears to be broken, as neither hand is moving.
Interesting.
Inexplicably so.
It'll just take a few minutes. He says,
I know.
Pause.
Okay, Claire. Short pause.
Thanks.
He hangs up.
Color me intrigued.
So, he glances sideways. What about that name? I'm ready this time.
What, you mean for the truck? Fabulous idea.
I twist around, look through the cab window, and tap my chin.
I'd say he looks like a Phil.
Beck smiles.
I have an uncle named Phil.
No shit. I pat the dashboard.
Uncle Phil it is.
We pull up to the speaker and I wonder if Beck is as grateful for the interruption as I am. One of us is going to have to break eventually. We give our orders and drive up to the window.
Here,
I say, taking a 20 from Kathy's can. I got this. Beck doesn't even put up a fight, which is both mildly curious and annoying. We pull into an empty parking spot while he divvies out Walt's burger and fries, then his own.
So,
he says, folding up the bag.
My food is still in there.
Oh, I know, and you'll get it.
But it's gonna cost you.
You mean more than the $20 I already dished out? Beck unwraps his burger, takes a bite, and nods.
It's good, too,
he says, his mouth full.
Real medievally.
I smile, wondering whether I'd rather punch him or jump him.
And what exactly does medieval food taste like?
He holds up the bag with my food in it.
Care to find out?
I've never been part of a conversation like this, where my heart is jelly and my brain is in my shoes. I should be pissed at his boyish antics, but right now should is miles away. On the radio, the broadcasters discuss an impending rain delay.
Blissfully engaged, Walt digs into his fries. Beck is already halfway done with his burger. I roll my eyes, sigh in my most overly dramatic tone, and offer my hand across Walt's back. Fine, I'll go first. Beck takes a bite while shaking it, and if I thought his look was stunning, his touch is downright majestic. I'm Mary Iris Malone, but only my mother gets to call me Mary. I'm in deep before I know it. With a few carefully omitted details, the breaking news, my war paint, my solar retinopathy. God, freak show anyone? I proceed to unload on Beck. I tell him about the divorce and the move and the conversation I overheard in the principal's office. I tell him about Mom's mystery disease in Cleveland and the series of letters I flushed down the bus toilet, my only proof of Kathy's awfulness. I tell him about the bus accident and Arlene and Walt and Caleb and our perilous rooftop episode, which landed us at the police station. It's that scene in the movie where the nervous girl just keeps talking and talking. But unlike the douchebags in those movies, Beck actually seems interested in what I'm saying. And I hate admitting this, probably because I don't like being the most predictable character in my own film. But I'd be lying if I said I wasn't wearing my cute face the entire time. I know my cute face when I feel it. Once done, I come up for air. Wait, where are we going? North, says Beck, merging onto the highway. You said Cleveland, right? I vaguely recall him starting up the engine during my soliloquy. What, you're gonna drive us? How else you plan on getting there? He hands over my food. And here, I officially lift the embargo. I'm not above eating fries while being indignant. If anything, indignation is bolstered by fries. These are amazing. Unless you forget, Uncle Phil belongs to me. I bought him with my cash monies. That's how we plan on getting to Cleveland. Yes they are. Unless you forget, I'm the one with the license. Just because I don't have a license... God, seriously, how good were these when they were warm? Never mind, I don't want to know. Anyway, I know how to drive. I'm sure you do, but really, it's no problem. I'm sort of passing through anyway. You're passing through Cleveland on your way to what, Lake Erie? He gives another one of those half smiles. Canada, actually, or Vermont. Before I have a chance to point out that Cleveland really isn't on the way to Canada or Vermont, the skies open up. It's a heavy rain, each drop bursting like a water balloon on the windshield. After a few minutes of squinting and leaning over the steering wheel, Beck gives up and pulls to the side of the highway to wait it out. In the new stillness of the truck, the warbled radio mixes with the pounding rain to create an odd sort of half-silence. Broadcasters are going through stats now, filling time during the rain delay. Walt has his hat pulled down over his face, but other than that, he hasn't budged.
So you're from Cleveland, then?
Says Beck, sipping his soda. I shake my head and unwrap the burger. After things went to shit, Mom sort of relocated there. It's where she always wanted to be anyway. I grew up in Ashland, about an hour outside Cleveland.
And she's in the hospital for this... disease, right? Your mom, I mean.
Reaching between my feet, I unzip my backpack and hand over the envelope with my mom's P.O. box address. For 2 months, I received a letter a week. Then, 3 weeks ago, they stopped. This was the last one I got, and the only one since the move.
You think your stepmom, Cassie?
Kathy.
Right, Kathy.
He hands back the envelope.
You think she's been hiding letters from you?
She always gets to the mailbox first. She tried to get me to quit calling so much. It's obvious she doesn't want us to communicate. Plus, I pull out Kathy's 6th letter. Here, this is the letter from Mom to Kathy, the only one I didn't flush. I'm pretty sure Mom asked if I could visit, to which Kathy said no, to which Mom replied,
"Think of what's best for her," says Beck.
Bingo. Beck holds it for a minute, slurps his drink.
It's got an error.
I know.
Think of what's best for her.
He holds up the note as if I haven't read it 100 times.
She forgot the apostrophe.
I know. He looks down at it again. What now, a dangling modifier?
He smiles, hands back the crumpled letter.
It's probably nothing.
Well, if it's probably nothing, then it might be something. What is it?
Nothing.
Well, you can't just say, hmm, and then say it's nothing. A hmm is something. You have to tell me.
He chews his straw in, I don't know what, knee-wobbling sensuality.
So, you just gonna go camp out at this P.O. box and hope your mom stumbles in from the hospital to check her mail?
I smile slash glare at him and, bloody hell, there's my cute face again. Strangely, I'm not as frustrated as I want to be. What I want to be is Beck's straw for 2 minutes. I swallow my last bite of burger, hoping he doesn't notice it took all of 20 seconds to inhale, then say, I have a plan, and it is this. Step one, get to Cleveland. Step two, figure shit out. This is my plan.
Flawless, if I may say so.
You may. Walt interrupts with a colossal snore. It tapers off a little, but still, how he fell asleep in that position is beyond me.
What's his story? Asks Beck.
I give him a brief rundown of what little I know of Walt. Dead mom, likes the shiny, new Chicago, etc. Honestly, I'm stalling a little, buying time to consider Beck's offer to drive us the rest of the way. It's attractive for a few reasons, the main one being, well, I've never driven on the highway. I haven't driven much at all, for that matter. With only one good eye, it makes for quite the Evel Knievel motocross-ass-grabbing death-defying experience. The stuff of YouTube legends, really. Beck clears his throat.
So, there's probably something you should know.
Here we go. Without meaning to, I reposition myself in the seat. My curiosity about Beck is suffocating, and it's just, I want so badly for him to be real, to be good, to be a person of major fucking substance and despair. He looks me directly in the eye, leans in, and says, Uncle Phil is a perv. At this, my brain splits into two very distinct factions. The first encourages me to gasp, to throw my hand over my mouth, to say, No, not Uncle Phil, Beck, darling, say it ain't so. The second sits in silence, unmoving, thoroughly disappointed.
Total degenerate, he continues. At the last family reunion, he told everyone his bald spot was a solar panel for his sex machine.
I sit in silence, unmoving. Thoroughly disappointed. The second faction appears to be winning out.
What?
He says, noticing my less than enthusiastic response.
I'm kidding! I mean, I'm not. Uncle Phil is a perv, but...
Beck. I sigh. And it's heavy, because even though I don't know anything about this guy, I'd bet all the cash in the can he's on Team Pizzazz. So what then? What's holding me back from going with my gut? Walt's Rubik's Cube falls from his lap. I pick it up and reach to turn off the radio.
And year out, the Cubs seem to get these great young prospects, only to watch them fizzle out, or never really reach their potential.
I pull my hand back, leaving the radio on. In my entire life, I've never once felt anything akin to a maternal instinct. On the baby fever scale, I check in from the tundra. Pretty typical for a 16-year-old, probably. But something about Walt has stirred me up. Brought out a protective side I never knew existed. More wolfish than motherly, perhaps, but still, something. The same something that's holding me back from going with my gut. And while I don't think Beck would harm us or even hinder us...
You okay?
Says Beck, watching me work things out. I look at the Rubik's Cube in my hand and wonder when me became us. We don't need you to get us anywhere, I say. Beck doesn't respond, and for just a moment I am reminded of my Odyssey's opening scene. Mim of the past, alone on an empty greyhound, marveling at the madness of the world, listening to the rain stampede across the metal roof like a herd of buffalo. Opening scenes are funny, because you never know which elements will change over time and which will stay the same. The world was, and is, mad. The rain was, and is, pouring. Looking at Walt, and yes, even Beck. I know one of my elements has definitely changed. I've gone from me to us.
I'm a junior at LSU.
Beck leans his head against the back of the seat.
Or I would have been.
How old is a college junior? This is immediately followed by, holy hell, what's wrong with me? I suppose the first faction of my brain won't go down without a fight.
Long story or short, he says, closing his eyes.
Long. And he begins, never once raising his head, never once opening his eyes. Walt's snoring, the radio, the rain, all of it fades while Beck talks. 3 years into a poli-sci major, he realized, A, he hated poli-sci, and B, he hated college. After a summer course in photography, here I choked down a gag reflex, he discovered his true passion, another gag. His parents, divorced, did not approve. He took what little savings he had and purchased a one-way Greyhound ticket from Baton Rouge to Burlington, Vermont. It was to be a photography pilgrimage, and once more.
My parents think I'm at school, he says. Big state school like that? It'll be another week, probably, before anyone realizes.
Lifting his head, he smiles, but his heart isn't in it. He unzips his duffel bag, pulls out the camera. We sit in silence for a few seconds while Beck takes pictures of the rain against the windshield.
And what about the shiner?
I point to his black eye. This being a milder version of what I'd like to ask. How did you end up in the Independence Police Station, He trains the camera on a bug trapped between the windshield and the wiper blade.
I punched a guy. Twice, actually. He got me once in between.
Jane Steiner, I whisper. He nods and begins a new story. And as soon as he starts, I know exactly how it will end. Chapter 24. The Coming Together of Ways. The door to the men's room was locked. Beck stood, waiting in the hallway, when a young Hispanic girl exited the ladies' room next to him. 19A and B must be mother and daughter, a beautiful Hispanic duo.
Her eyes, said Beck, were puffy and red, and I thought it was odd, but she was probably 13, and with girls that age, you just never know.
Seconds later, Beck saw a grown man come out of the same ladies' room. His eyes were strange, like glazed over or something. I notice his eyes are wet and shiny, but it's not from crying or the rain. The man shrugged, pointed to the locked men's room, said,
It couldn't wait.
Minutes later, Beck entered the men's room, did his business, and, while washing his hands, peered into the mirror. Behind him was a single stall. He frowned and stepped back into the hallway. When he knocked on the ladies' room, there was no answer. He poked his head inside, gave a faint, Hello? Still, nothing. Confident no one was inside, Beck entered the ladies' room, letting the door close behind him.
It just felt odd, you know?
Said Beck, his camera dangling from his neck.
Like, dim or something.
The bathroom dissolves into a reddish hue, the corners dimming like the vignette of an old art house film. Beck looked around, noted the single stall. One stall. He remembered the look on the face of the girl only minutes ago, puffy and red from crying, and he felt the blood rush from his face to his gut. His words are ice. They hit my gut first, then spread in all directions. Turning, Beck exited the ladies' room, walked down the hall and into the main dining area.
I saw the girl first thing, said Beck. She was sitting in a booth with her mom and another couple. Her mom was chit-chatting across the table, but the little girl, that girl wasn't saying a word. She looked shell-shocked.
We'd seen the footage of the hyena and the gazelle, and it always ended the same. When Beck scanned the room, he found the man sitting on a bar stool, eating pie,
as if nothing had happened. Nothing will happen, he says, his voice thick. Nothing you don't want.
Beck walked calmly to the bar. Tapped the man on the shoulder.
And I punched him. Twice. In front of a cop.
What? Beck adjusts the focus of his camera, goes back to taking pictures while he talks.
It actually ended up turning out okay. The cop was this gung-ho idiot starved for action.
Randy. With the huge head?
Yeah, you know him?
Sort of. No, not really. It doesn't matter. Go on. Beck raises an eyebrow and scans through the photos he just shot. He hasn't met my eyes for a while now, and I wonder if there's something he's not telling me. There are only so many angles a person can get of rain on a windshield.
Officer Randy interrogated us, he says, and pretty much sorted it out. I got a lifetime ban from Greyhound for fighting, and spent my last few dollars at a Red Roof Inn in Union last night. They called me in this morning for some follow-up questions, then turned me loose.
And what about Poncho Man? Beck stops taking pictures, but he doesn't look at me. How do you know he was wearing a poncho? I hear my mother's voice in my ear. Tell him. I remember him. I remember a creepy-looking guy is all. In a poncho.
Beck takes a second before he answers my question. He's in jail.
They arrested him?
Had to. The little girl spoke up.
I look out at the rain and think back to the flashing blue lights in the parking lot of Jane's Diner. I knew I wasn't his first. And if I'm honest with myself, I knew I wouldn't be his last. But I could have been. I could have said something. I could have saved that little girl myself, made it so it never happened. But my objective had come first. And now, because of me, some little girl will never be the same. I slip on Albert's aviators and let the tears come, hard and heavy. Life can be a real son of a bitch sometimes, bringing things back around long after you've said goodbye. Not only am I selfish, I'm a coward. That little girl spoke up. She did what I couldn't do.
She did what you wouldn't do, Mary.
We should go, says Walt out of nowhere. Honestly, I'd forgotten he was even here. I look at him. He's wide awake, smiling like a kid on Christmas morning, and fight the urge to throw my arms around his neck, just kiss his cheeks for all of eternity. Beck looks at me quizzically, then back at Walt.
Go where, buddy?
To the game, Walt says, turning up the radio.
And now that the rain has finally stopped, I can't imagine a more perfect day at the ballpark. So, once again, if any listeners are interested, we still have 7 innings of baseball to play, and I'm being told there are plenty of tickets available.
At that moment, the rain stops. Walt looks up and points through the windshield. The entire city of Cincinnati is spread before us in a breathtaking panorama. I take in this new clearness of the day with my good eye, in absolute awe of the sudden and wonderful metamorphosis. It's a landscape worthy of documentation.
Beck,
I whisper.
On it, he says, raising his camera, snapping away.
How strange. Only minutes ago, Beck was aiming in the same direction, documenting something else altogether. The city, in all its grandeur, had been there the whole time, hidden by the storm. Walt claps his hands, squeals, bounces in his seat. Before I have a chance to settle him down, Beck turns his camera from the Cincinnati skyline to Walt, and for just a moment, the scene eases into slow motion. Beck's smile is intense and sincere, a smile with, not a smile at. Mom used to say you could tell a lot by the way a person treats the innocent, and Walt is nothing if not innocence personified. Ricky was, too. I think about Tyzarnstorf and all his little bully clones united in their mutual disdain for kids who strayed from the pack. No matter that the stray was harmless, gullible, weak. No matter that Ricky eventually gave up trying to make friends and settled into a pathetic desire to be left alone. No matter that I was a friend to Ricky that one summer, then, God save me, ignored him on the playground, and in class, and in the cafeteria, and in the gym. Son of a bitch, I can't believe I did that. And my instincts are no better off now. Rather than join in the laughter, the unadulterated joy, as Beck did, my knee-jerk reaction to Walt's excitement was to calm him down, minimize his embarrassment, minimize my own. I turned to look out the window, smiling my own smile, more timid than I'd like. And I cry. I cry thinking about the Rickies and Walts of the world smiling in the face of all those Tyzarnstorfs. I cry because I've never smiled like that, not once in my life. I cry because I love. For some reason, I always have.
Chapter 25. Our Only Color. September 3, late afternoonish.
Dear Isabel, your mother and I are getting divorced.
7 words. All it took to wash away the millions that came before. I'd heard them in movies, on TV, read them in books. I'd heard them probably dozens of times in my life, yet somehow never in my life, you know? Mom said a few words about taking care of herself. Dad nodded during that part. Ironically, this was the most evident display of unity I'd seen from them in years. After Mom's bit, Dad gave a little speech about doing what was right for our family, no matter how difficult, and they hadn't worked out all the specifics yet, but it didn't change how much they loved me and blah, blah, blah. It was the kind of speech where the first line was the only one that mattered. Your mother and I are getting divorced. Done. Ball game. That is the speech. The night they told me, I barely slept. And when I did, it was uneasy. This letter contains no reasons, so if you'd like to skip it, Iz, go right ahead. Honestly, I'm not even sure who these words are for. You or me. In a dream, I sat on the edge of my parents' bed, alone in their room. My stomach burned, and my throat too, like lava. I could feel my tongue forming words, and while I sensed their urgency, I couldn't hear them. Something fell from my hands, landed on the carpet with a dull thud. I looked down and noticed my bare feet. How had they grown so old? I wondered. Rising from the bed, I saw those old feet sink into the carpet. I kept a close eye on them because they weren't mine, and you just can't trust someone else's feet. Like a rusty freighter on the Atlantic, I drifted across the room. It took hours, days, years even. By the time my hip nudged the edge of my mother's vanity, I'd come to terms with my old age. Raising my head by inches, I saw the red wood of the vanity's curved legs, the cabinets with those shiny brass handles, and resting on top, my mother's makeup tray. Normally, the tray was full of her favorite perfumes, blushes, eyeliners, and concealers. But just then, it held only one item. Her lipstick. The very lipstick she'd used on my one and only makeover. In the dream, I could feel the vanity's tall mirror looming. I must look up, I thought. I spent a lifetime, crossed an ocean to look up. I looked up. I laughed. Cried. Laughed. I am not me, I said to the ocean, to the old feet, to the face in the mirror. And it was true. In the dream, the reflection staring back was not my own. It was my mother's. I raised my chin, my eyebrows, and hands. I watched the chin, eyebrows, and hands of my mother in the mirror. I opened my mouth. Her mouth opened. I winked. She winked back. I spoke. She spoke. Mary can't possibly understand what I'm trying to say, we said. Fine, we replied. She'll understand this. We picked up the lipstick. Calmly, we removed the cap and drew on our face. A Ferris wheel, fireworks, a diamond ring, a bottle, a record. As soon as we finished each one, the drawings disappeared. We drew faster, 1,000 things, each one more indistinct than the last. The final drawing was more methodical. In the mirror, our hands and face came together to paint the sky. Left cheek first, one decisive stroke. We drew the two-sided arrow, brought it to a point at the bridge of our nose, then the line across our forehead. The third brushstroke mirrored the first, an arrow on the right cheek. We drew a thick line from forehead to chin, and finally, a dot inside both arrows. It disappeared, so we drew it again. And again, and again, like some sad automaton doomed to an existence of unvaried motion. Finally, it stuck. We dropped the lipstick to the floor where it splashed between our old feet. Our face was old, too, all the blood drained away. The war paint is our only color, we said. The next morning, I woke up in a sweat. From my bedroom, I could hear Dad down the hall talking in low tones. I got up, and without even bothering to put on pants, crept toward my parents' bedroom. Their door was cracked open just enough to see inside. Dad sat on the edge of his bed, talking on the phone. His voice sounded tired, and even from my limited vantage point, I could see the outlines of dark rings under his eyes. I could see that he was wearing the same clothes as yesterday. He said goodbye, then hung up and sat there for a second. I pushed open the door. "Hi, honey," he said, turning sideways. "I didn't know you were awake." "Dad," I said simply. It was enough. He began talking, using words that made no sense at all. She had to leave. I stood in the door, half naked, holding my breath, rearranging what truths I thought I knew.
"It'll only be for a while until she figures things out."
His words were oblong, misshapen. They fit into none of my known boxes, so I was forced to create a new one. In red pen, it was labeled, "Grow Up."
She wanted to say goodbye, but this was for the best.
As he talked, I stepped inside this new box, pulled the lid shut over my head, hugged my knees to my chest, screamed my guts out, surrendered myself to all the worst things from all the worst places.
"Mim?
You okay?" My box melted. "Am I okay?" I stared at him for a second, unable to buy any of it. Across the room, I saw Mom's vanity, the tall mirror, the red wood, the curved legs. My heart sank when I saw the makeup tray. I swept across the room, careful not to look at my feet. The dream was still too close. "Mim, put on some clothes. Let's talk about this." The makeup tray, usually full of her perfumes, blushes, eyeliners, concealers, was empty. All of it gone, save one item. The lipstick. It sat on the tray like unwanted leftovers.
"Mim," said Dad.
I grabbed the lipstick off the tray and turned for the door.
"Mim!"
But I was gone. Back in my room, I stood in front of my own rarely used mirror, recalled the war paint from my dream, and began. And it felt good. I do not know why. For the next 2 months, we stayed in that house, during which time a number of things happened, including, but not limited to, 1. I found the words, 10 easy steps to a 10-day divorce, left in the Google search bar of the family computer. And, 2. My parents were divorced 12 days later, compelling me to wonder which of the easy steps my father had botched. And, 3. Kathy, who had once waited on us at Denny's, started coming around the house. And 4, I received no less than one hollow-sounding letter a week from my mother, assuring me that all was well, that I would be seeing her soon, etc., etc., which led me to 5, beg Dad if I could live with Mom in Cleveland, to which he responded 6, out of the question, to which I responded 7, what the hell is going on, to which he 8, married Kathy and moved us way the hell away from Mom, bringing us to 9. When Mom's letters stopped, her phone was disconnected, and I was left 110% alone in this world, an island unto myself, a sad, lost little person living in one mosquito-ridden sweat storm of an ass-backwards state. My whole fucking world had fallen apart, Isabel. That's the long and short of it. And no matter where I turned, I got no answers. For a while, I was pissed at my mom. Honestly, I could have survived all of it, even the breaking news, if I could have counted on that one letter, hollow-sounding or not, per week. Just one. But I'm beginning to suspect something, and it's almost too awful for words. Among the reasons behind Dad's recent actions, and there are many, what if one of them is her disease? What if Dad got rid of my mom because she's sick? Signing off, Mary Iris Malone, an island unto myself. Cincinnati, Ohio, 249 miles to go. Chapter 26. Remember the Rendezvous Ski. A flock of teenage girls stands in front of us in line, each one carrying identical shopping bags. The bags depict a group of ripped, shirtless dudes on a pier. Plastered across the top in bold marquee lettering, it says, "Live your life." It's an odd feeling, being chagrined by your own generation. Long ago, I traded my pie-in-the-sky idealism, as it relates to what people are like and what they are interested in.